Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there. It is so nice. It snowed the other day. Not supposed to do that in April, but I missed it because I wasn't in New York at that time. And it's beautiful outside, and we have a really, really great show, and I have a fantastic guest. But before I introduce my New York Times bestselling author, I promised some people in Cherry Hill, New Jersey from Cafe Flora that I would say hi and thanks for the outstanding egg whites and fruit because it's Passover and I can't eat bread, and it was great. So I'll be back again. And thank you to the people at Plaza, Central Plaza Diner, for having the matzah and for always, always having whatever I want and treating people so special. That's why I did the banner for you and do your promotions all the time. And for those of you that would like to submit an article to MJ Magazine Edition 4, I'm looking for what's your opinion on medical marijuana, should it be legalized, gun control, what kind of laws do we need? Homework, how much is too much homework for children in any grade? And daylight savings time and Eastern Standing Time, do we really need it? And if you're really nice, I'll give you my picks, what I think you should read at the end of the show. You can't have everything, you know. So I would like to introduce the author of a phenomenal mystery romance suspense. It's got everything. To save her only brother, Andrea Finch must face down a criminal mastermind, the FBI, and her own demons in this thrilling hardcover debut from author of best-selling Tracer series. I would like to welcome Laura Griffin. Hi.
Hi, Fran. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm just so excited that you're here. So why the title Far Gone?
Well, that actually, it came about, and I was consulting with my editor about it. She always has good title ideas. We were looking for something that kind of worked on several levels. So on one level, Far Gone is about Andrea's relationship with her brother, and she's worried that he's kind of beyond her reach, and that's part of, you know, the whole plot of the story. But then on another level, as she starts to fall for this FBI agent that she crosses paths with in the story, it's kind of also about, you know, being gone for a guy. So it's kind of got a double meaning.
Yeah. It does, and she gets far gone over him, that's for sure. Just the description of John North is amazing, that everybody's going to want to be the character in the book, and they're going to be jealous.
Oh, it's so great.
Oh, my God. But she gets her back up against the wall, and she's a force to be reckoned with, so forget about it. So when creating the storyline for this novel, why did you focus on the Oklahoma bombing?
Well, actually, this is sort of it just kind of came about. I was doing some book research, and I was visiting with some FBI agents, and it was April, the month of April, and they kept mentioning April 19th, which was only a couple of days away. And so I asked, you know, what's that about? And they said, oh, well, you know, April 19th, it's the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. It's the anniversary of Waco. And I started to think about that. I just had never made the connection that so many significant events in American history happened on that date. It's the opening battle of the American Revolution, known as the shot heard around the world. So there was just all these American history connections in the recent history and also in the past, more distant history, that have to do with April 19th. And as I started researching it, I just started to kind of think about this suspense plot that could be focused on this sort of ominous day that's looming and sinister things that might happen on that day. So, you know, so it started with a real thing that you know, I got kind of this spark of the idea from some law enforcement officers that I was talking to, but then later I just kind of took it in a different direction.
That was really, as I tell you, so interesting, because once I picked up the book, I get eye strain a lot, people, from reading too many books. And what happens when a book is really good, I get double eye strain because I can't put it down.
Oh.
Which means that once I started the book, I couldn't stop until I finished it. So the next day I didn't read anything.
Oh, well, I'm glad you couldn't put it down. That's always good to hear.
Yeah, I couldn't put it down. And lately I've been reading a lot of books that, the sad part is that I've been reading a lot of books, and I won't say which ones they are, that I started 11 books in the last 3 days, and only two of them remain on the table to be read. And the others I will read is just that, I just couldn't get in, can't get into them, which is really not like me, but what can you do? Everything isn't always perfect. And the ones that I find the most difficult are the self-help. I'm doing my best. So how did you create Andrea Finch, and what are her strong suits?
Well, Andrea is an interesting character to me. She's an Austin police detective. She's a homicide detective in Austin. I live in Austin. And so I was really interested in just kind of a law enforcement officer that's a woman, and just kind of the challenges she has just being a woman in sort of a field that's more traditionally dominated by men. And so I really had fun researching this. I spoke with a lot of female police officers and just what is that like? Of course, it's getting better, you know, over the years, but it's tough. And I mean, just even just the physical aspects of the job, you know, how do you muscle a 200-pound drunk guy into your police car? I mean, if you're, you know, 5'3". So, I mean, there's all different aspects of the job. And so I interviewed a lot of female police officers and just tried to get a sense of, you know, what that's like. And I just kind of came up with this really tough woman. I mean, she's got a softer side, too, and that kind of comes out in the story. You see it in her relationship with her brother, who she's very close to. And then you see it in her feelings for the hero, John, later in the story. But at first, she kind of comes off very tough. And, you know, she's kind of got this just this defensive way of approaching the world. But, you know, there's more to her. It's just that she has a lot of, you know, some things in her past and have made her just kind of a little bit closed off and a little bit wary of people.
Well, what caused her to make this split decision? I don't know if you want to talk about the split decision, but that's what changed everything in her life.
Well, it's in the opening scene.
Yeah.
It's basically, when I was talking to these police officers, I basically came to understand that one of their worst nightmare scenarios would be to be involved in a shooting. In this particular situation there, she's in a public space and there's sort of a hostage situation that comes about, and she's ends up facing off against this man who's got a gun trained on some innocent people. And this man in the scene is really young. It turns out he's 18 years old. So she's looking at this kid basically, and she has to make a decision, you know, whether to pull the trigger. And, she's just kind of wrestling with that in the moment. And she has a brother who's not much older than the person she's aiming her gun at. And I just think that it's just about her moral dilemma in that moment, and then she makes the decision. And then the aftermath of that decision, you know, just the finality of the decision and the aftermath and everything that happens afterwards just basically turns her whole world upside down. Her career, her relationships, everything in her world gets turned upside down the moment that she pulls the trigger. So that's where the story begins. It begins where she's in this kind of moment of crisis and then kind of goes from there.
Well, what would have happened if she didn't pull the trigger? How would that have changed things?
You know, I think based on the way the situation was unfolding, I think that the gunman would have killed at least one of the innocent people that was standing there in the scene. He was one of these, you know, he had a breakup, kind of was the inciting incident for this. And so I think he would have at least killed his girlfriend, his ex-girlfriend. So, and, you know, these kinds of domestic scenes spill over into the public sometimes. And, you know, you read about them in the newspaper.
Yeah.
But I was interested in what would it have been like for a police officer in that moment? I mean, could you really do that? You know, if you think you have what it takes to be a police officer, could you really face off against someone and pull the trigger? I think it would be very, it'd be really difficult to do and really difficult not to do. I mean, either way, you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't. So
that was what I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
She paid the price for that, and it really wasn't fair. So it shows you how well, you know, internal affairs, whatever, can turn against you, even though what she did was right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of those situations are open to interpretation. So she kind of finds herself at odds with her apartment after it happens. And so she's put on leave. And when she's on leave, she's kind of going into a downslide. She's kind of in a funk. in the aftermath of this event that happens, and she's on leave, just kind of waiting to find out what her fate is career-wise. And that is when she gets this distress call from her younger brother, who they're very close because their parents were, you know, they were sort of orphaned at a young age, and so they're very close. They just basically have each other. And she gets this distress call. He needs money. He won't tell her why. And she just, all her alarm bells go off. She knows her brother. She knows the sort of problems he's had in the past. And she knows that whatever this is that he needs money for, this is not, something's wrong, something's amiss. She can tell just by talking to him. And so they basically have an argument, and then she ends up going out to investigate why is he in West Texas and what is going on. And that's where the main story starts to happen, is that she goes out there to get answers, and that's when she meets the FBI agent who's also out there in West Texas looking for answers to something else.
Well, they're instantly attracted, but like a magnet in the opposite direction to start with.
Yeah, they're very different. Well, they're different, but they're also, they have certain ways that they're similar.
Yeah.
They're both very strong, determined, stubborn people, and, you know, you put them together and there's friction, but, in, you know, it's good friction in some ways. So, but they have a lot to overcome. She knows right away, she realizes that that the FBI agent, John, the hero, is investigating the people that her brother is living with. And so she knows, because she's a law enforcement officer, she knows that means that he's investigating her brother. She knows that. So right away she's wary. She doesn't trust him. She thinks that he's manipulating her to get inside information, which he is. And so she just knows. She has her guard up from the beginning. And it makes it hard for her to open up to him, to trust him. And that's kind of the crux of their relationship challenge from the very beginning of the story.
So how does he get her to work with him? Because they wind up working together somehow, even though they're sort of polar opposites, but not really.
It's kind of a wearing down. I mean, the more she gets to know him and understand what he's investigating and why, she starts to understand that he's really, you know, his heart is in the right place. He really believes that he's stumbled onto something that's very important and maybe a broad plot. At first, he tells her that he's just investigating a murder, but she kind of senses that there's more to it. And as the story unfolds, she starts to learn exactly what it is that he's investigating. And it's just a lot more chilling than she originally had thought. She thought it was a cold case, but it's not only a cold case. It's a much broader case. And so she understands where he's coming from, and she wants to work with him. She wants to help him. She wants to also get answers to these questions. I mean, at heart, she's a police officer, so she cares about, you know, the public safety. And if she feels like there's this plot kind of brewing from this underground organization, she wants to put a stop to it. What she's not happy about is that she thinks her brother might be involved, and so she's kind of torn between her duties as a police officer and her love for her family. And that's basically her moral dilemma in the story, is that she doesn't know which to choose, and she feels like she has to choose.
So how does a murder that happened 6 years before and a string of bank robberies and a man named Shay Harden come into play in the present?
Well, it begins with this this man that the FBI agent John is investigating. His name is Shay Harden, and he has a history of just basically hatred for the federal government. And so he's done a lot of things over the years. You know, he's written angry letters to the newspaper and had public confrontations, this, that. But he was also a suspect in a murder case of a federal judge. And in the story, this is a federal judge who had ruled on a case of eminent domain, which means that he had basically ruled in favor of the government that they could seize the land that his parents owned. So he basically, ever since that, he's had a grudge against the federal government. And so he's one of these people, he's got this and it starts to fester. And so there's all these different ways in which he's just kind of nursing this grievance. And so his name comes up in the murder investigation when this judge is killed. And our hero, John, can never really let go of that idea that the man got away with murder, that he kind of, he set it up very carefully and he got away with it. And so 6 years later, he's convinced his supervisor to let him reopen the case, and he goes out there with a small team. and he's investigating, and he starts to uncover more and more information that just kind of raises all these red flags. And he thinks not only did the guy kill this judge, but he thinks he's engaged in a plot today now. He thinks he's planning something very sinister for the date of April 19th, which, as we said, had, you know, some historic significance in America. So he thinks that this is kind of going to be his big, you know, statement about, you know, everything that he's angry about. So so he's investigating all of this, and there's all these kind of different little things he finds, little clues. You know, how are they funding this activity? Our villain lives on a compound with a group of people that are like-minded, and you know, the question is, how are they getting their money? What are they doing for resources? How are they funding their activities? And so he starts to investigate each little piece of the puzzle and starts to find clues. And Andrea starts to help him.
You know, what I found really interesting, though, is that these people had this specific type of technology that was put them off the radar. So what kind of research did you do in order to find out? I mean, there were so many different ways. They couldn't find cell phone records. They couldn't find computer records. They couldn't find anything. What kind of research did you go into being able to get off the radar where then no one was able to detect that these people were doing what they were doing or anything?
Yeah. Well, I did a lot of research about lone wolf terrorism and also just various types of terrorism we've had domestically over the years. And some of the toughest criminals for the FBI to catch over the years have been the ones that were not plugged into all this digital network. So, for example, Ted Kaczynski, he eluded law enforcement for so long. And one of the reasons he did that is he was holed up in a cabin in Montana. He wasn't on the Internet. He wasn't making phone calls. And, I mean, he was living a very primitive survivalist lifestyle. And in doing so, he was able to elude detection and elude capture and for many, many years. So what they've, you know, one of the ideas that gets talked about in the book is that after 9/11, the government, our government, started having a lot more surveillance. And even after the Oklahoma City bombing, which happened earlier, you know, our government started doing more surveillance of some of these groups, groups such as the group that Tim McVeigh was affiliated with. And a lot of these groups decided to go underground. So they realized that, you know, if they were communicating online, if they were emailing, if they were using the Internet, you know, and phones to communicate, that they could be detected. And so a lot of that went underground. And so that's what is going on in this case. This is a group that is very smart, and they have decided that if they want to keep their activities secret, they're not going to be able to use all the technology that is available. And so that's their way of kind of outsmarting the feds.
Well, one of the main things that we talked about even before the show and right now is gun control. So what role does gun control, why is it so easy for people to purchase handguns in some states, and we all know which states they are, and should stricter laws be put in place? And John faces so many obstacles when he tries to get this guy. So where does gun control come into play? Because that's one of the issues I found in the book that I found very important.
Well, yeah, and it is kind of a debate that comes up in the story. You know, the person they're investigating, one of his fears is disarmament, and he feels very strongly about his Second Amendment rights, and he takes that very seriously. You know, it would be easy to say he's just a crackpot, but, you know, I grew up in Texas, and in Texas, the right to own a gun is just considered, I mean, it's just taken for granted. So guns are pretty much everywhere. I mean, they're just all around. So it's just a different mindset based on where you are in the country, based on, you know, your background. In the story, Andrea, the heroine, is she grew up on a farm. And so she kind of has the attitude of, what's the big deal? You know, I grew up around guns my whole life. I don't understand the big deal. And there are a lot of people that feel that way. And then the flip side is someone who feels like, you know, there need to be more controls in place. So it's kind of two sides of the issue looked at in the story. But anyway, they decide that they're going to hone in on some of the guns that he has and see if they could use that as a way to try and get an arrest warrant so they can kind of uncover what else is going on, what else he's plotting, because they know that he's up to something. And so that's part of the story.
Well, why is Andrea believes, even though John is not sure, why does she think that her brother is really innocent of all of this, yet you really don't know? Because if he's working with these people, and he seems to be often, and like he actually at some point, I think he was a little naive about these people or just didn't want to admit what was happening. Why is she so bent on defending her brother?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the story, Andrea and her brother, they're raised by a single mom who's got an addiction problem, and she dies when they are young. And so they go to live with their grandparents on a farm in Texas. It's a rice farm. And so they grow up in this kind of rural setting with her grandparents. And so Andrea is really close with her brother, and she, in a way, she kind of raises him because the grandparents are so much older. And so she really feels like she's a part of his upbringing, and she feels very maternal toward him. And she watches him have a very, very difficult time growing up, and he's bullied at school, and he doesn't fit in mm-hmm. with the farm boys in the town where they're growing up. He's different. You know, he just doesn't fit in. He's kind of a misfit. And so her whole life, she's spent trying to protect him and stand up for him and kind of fight these battles for him. And so at first, her knee-jerk reaction when she feels like he's being unfairly accused of something is to defend him. And she just knows kind of the gentle soul that he is. And she knows that, you know, based on his upbringing and, you know, who their family is, she just doesn't believe he would be capable of something so horrendous as murdering innocent people. And so she just doesn't believe that he could be capable of it. And she doesn't believe in her heart that his moral compass has gotten so out of whack that he would do that. And so it's just her faith in him that has her throughout the story just fighting for him and just so determined to convince the FBI that they're wrong about him. And so, and you know, that's just one of the story questions from the very beginning is he involved or isn't he involved? And that was it's just something that she's as interested in the answer to that question as the FBI.
I just crossed out the next question. I just remembered which one you didn't want to say about.
Yeah, there's spoilers.
Yeah, and there's another one, and then there's one more person that I think we'll just leave that person her out.
Okay.
I think that that was the question that you mentioned before, and I said okay, and I just remembered that, and it was the next one. Okay, but yet the evidence points to him. And it's hard to learn the truth. Just how smart is Hardin? And would you describe him as a radical? He was an interesting character.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that I found really interesting when I was researching this villain was just how, you know, he's so strongly motivated by his ideology, and he believes it 100%. And that's what makes him such a tough adversary for law enforcement, because he really believes in everything he's doing. He's very opinionated, and he's got a lot of grievances, and they're not unfounded. And so in some ways you can kind of see where the villain is coming from. And Andrea makes that point in the story. She says, look, I can understand his argument. He's got grievances against the federal government, and I see where he's coming from. I would be mad too. But, the way he chooses to, you know, fight back is where it gets, you know, obviously, where that's where the problem is. That's where his that's where he crosses all the lines. So I did a lot of research about terrorists that we've had, homegrown terrorists in our country. You know, Tim McVeigh is the one that I focused a lot of attention on, but there have been others. You know, Ted Kaczynski, Eric Rudolph. There are a bunch of them, and just what are the motivators for these people? What is it they're mad about? How can they bring themselves to do the things they do? And where does this come from? And it was pretty grim research in some ways. And I kind of had to, you know, try to find places in the story to kind of lighten things up and kind of focus on more positives because I didn't want the story to be just heavy at all times. I wanted there to be some lighter moments. And, you know, it's also, in addition to being a suspense story, there's also a romance in there, and I wanted to have some time to kind of focus on that and focus on the relationships in the story and not just, you know, the villain.
Well, what made it great is that the romance took time and that it didn't just happen. And then it happened over time and it made sense. Because sometimes when a romance writer writes a novel, you know, okay, in chapter two, that's it. They're going to just do it and it's get it over with here. And then you lose the rest of the novel. So it made it really great to guess, are these two ever going to, you know, just stand still and look at each other and realize it's too late, give it a rest. So when John interviews Gavin, that was a really powerful scene. Why was he so closed-mouthed, and why was he show his allegiance to Hardin? Why didn't he just say what was going on? What was he afraid of?
I think that he had kind of been drinking the Kool-Aid. This is Andrea's brother. I think that the way he defends Hardin in the interview, it just kind of shows that, I mean, Hardin was a master manipulator. He was very charismatic and had a way of persuading people to his perspective. And so Gavin had kind of, in a way, fallen under his spell and really adopted a lot of his ideology. So you know, you see that in the scene where the FBI agent is interviewing him. You know, he's very defensive and he's sticking up for someone. And he feels very strongly about it. So, yeah, that was a tense scene. Because you almost... You're almost dreading what he's going to say. So
it was better that maybe what he didn't say was even better than what he did say, which was really good. It kept you in suspense because you had no idea which way he was going to go. So who is Vicky, and why did she play such a great role in Gavin's life? Why did he? I mean, there are guys out there that'll give up everything for some girl that's whatever. In which case they really have to start thinking and looking at things more carefully. So why did he think that this girl was so wonderful, and what did Andrea think about that?
Well, you know, Andrea, as I said before, she knows kind of the softer side of her brother, and she knows that he's, like I said, she doesn't believe that he's morally capable of these things that the FBI believes he did. And she knows the softer side of him, but she can't understand how he can be involved with this kind of criminal group. She just doesn't understand. She feels like she's missing something. And when she discovers that he's in love with one of the women that lives on the compound, it suddenly makes more sense to her. She starts to understand, okay, now I'm understanding the attraction here. He didn't just come out to this ranch in the middle of nowhere because of an idea. He's fallen in love with this woman. But she believes her brother is very young and very naive, and he's intellectually very smart, but in terms of kind of the ways of the world, Andrea is a hardened police detective. She's kind of seen it all. She got her start on the police squad working on the Vice squad, and so she's kind of seen it all, and she believes her brother is being very naive. So she thinks that he's kind of missing something, you know, that he's being kind of led astray by this woman. She's a cynic, and he isn't, so.
Yeah, well, she sort of sees things the way you and I would see them, and she sees things through rose-colored glasses, hoping that his life will turn out great. He didn't want to see anything negative, and he really didn't look at Hardin the way he was supposed to also. But for those people out there that are listening, you're going to have to read the book to find out the rest, because I'm not giving away anymore.
Okay,
we're going to talk
you.
About other questions, and you're going to have to just read the book Far Gone. And if you get eye strain reading it in one sitting, that's too bad. That means the book is really great, and what can I say? But before I forget, my picks for this month are, for those people that are over 50, I won't say who they are, and think that seniors don't have it all together, but they do, Arts and Crafts, and it's not about Arts and Crafts, by J.T. Prescott, will let you know that three retired seniors, one that used to work for the CIA in covert operations, a financial wizard and a lawyer, put together an operation that takes down a government plot. You have to read it to believe it. And they discuss their business in a senior citizens facility in a room called the Arts and Crafts Room with under the guise of doing an art project called Death in Art, for real. And, of course, Far Gone by Laura Griffin is fantastic. And the Medici Boy, you've got to read it. It's absolutely great. And a book that I am not finished with, I am three-quarters finished with, that I think that everyone that wants to know what really happened in Chicago, what the black people went through, their lives, an autobiography of Black Chicago by Travis, Dempsey Travis, is probably one of the best books I've read in a very long time. That's one of the books that made it to my I'm going to finish it right away pile, and I'm reviewing it for Book Pleasures, and I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to get it to be 800 words when I could say about 2,000. Seriously. Yeah, the book is really good, and that one made it to my read pile, and there were like two more that made it to my read pile. Desperate Justice by Dennis Carstens. If he's lucky, can get through this. Whatever. Yeah, I'm gonna finish that one. It's absolutely excellent too. So those people are my picks for the month. And tell me, how did you, when you create your villain, what are some of the attributes that you look for when you're creating the bad guy in a novel?
Well, just as a reader, when I'm reading a story that has a villain, you know, you want him to be multidimensional. I mean, the one I always think about is Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, where he's this horrible, vicious person, but he's so mistreated by his psychiatrist in the institution. He's kind of being taunted and tortured by the psychiatrist. In a way, you're almost rooting for him in the story and rooting against the psychiatrist who's kind of taunting him the whole time. So I think that, the most compelling villains have two sides to them. You hate them, 90% of the way, but there's this little percent where you're just kind of, you kind of see what they're doing, you understand. And so I think when you can kind of see them from multiple perspectives, that you can, create a good villain.
It's interesting because in order to get, then how did you create John and Andrea? I mean, when you create the romance, the romantic interest for the other person, how do you decide, exactly what the chemistry is going to be? Because there are a lot of people listening that are, try to write romance novels, but it's like I said, it falls by the wayside if the romance happens too fast or if it gets to be, there's too much friction. You say, okay, when are they going to ever get to the point? So how do you create that perfect mix between the two love interests?
Well, that's always hard. I don't know if I ever create the perfect mix, but I think one thing that I try to remember is just that, if you're gonna make an entire book about two people, there has to be a pretty good conflict between them, and it can't just be something that can be settled by an argument, or it's not an episode of Three's Company where it's all just a misunderstanding, and it's just almost comical. So you have to have kind of a core conflict that's not easily resolved, and if it's easily resolved in the first chapter or two, then you're kind of out, your story kind of runs out of steam. So it has to be something that really does take some time and work to get through, and your characters have to grow and change in order to, work through this conflict that they have. In this book, it's the conflict of, she's torn between her loyalty to her brother, who she loves, her family, and her duties as a police officer, and she understands where the hero is coming from in investigating her brother, but she doesn't want to help him. And I think that kind of dilemma that she has is what is the core of their conflict, is that she, as she starts to care about him, she's also feeling disloyal and feeling just this sense of betraying her family.
Well, next question. How long did it take you to, before I ask that next question, everybody's dying to know, are you bringing these two back?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know yet.
I left the door open for them. I did leave the door open for them. I think there could be more to say about John and Andrea. I like them a lot. Sometimes I finish a book and I kind of miss the characters after the book is done. So these two fall into that category. So I haven't closed the door on them. I've left the door open for possible future stories with them. The thing I'm working on right now, though, is another book in my Tracer series, and so
that's question.
That's where my focus has been in the last few months. I'm working on a new Tracer's book, And for your listeners that don't know the Tracers are they're an elite group of forensic scientists who work at the Delphi Center Crime Lab, and they are kind of involved in some of the most cutting-edge forensic work going on, and they help homicide detectives, cold case detectives, basically any case that is tough to solve, they can kind of come in and take a crack at it. And so the Delphi Center Crime Lab is where all these interesting forensic things happen. So I've enjoyed writing the series because each book focuses mm-hmm. on a different sort of forensic technique and a different tracer, a different person, and mm-hmm. they kind of feature different people. And so I've had a chance to interview all different forensic experts and learn all different kinds of things. And it never gets boring because if I get bored with one area, I just kind of switch to something new, and there's just always more to learn. And so it's been a fun series. So I've got a new book coming up in the Tracer series.
When is it coming out? I have to write this down so I don't forget to email you. Please send me the book.
I don't know for sure. It's coming out in 2015, but I'm not sure of the date yet. I'll keep you posted.
right now we don't have a title yet.
So we have. I know it's coming out in 2015, but I'll let you know the exact release date as that becomes decided. I don't know what it is yet.
It'll be another one of those. I read part of her Tracer series. It's another, series that you read in zap time, people, and that you can't put down. Yeah, the characters are really great, and what's great, like you said, they're all different, and it's all different people. So when creating your novels, this is a question that authors constantly ask in the chat room. Other people ask, when you create your novels, do you outline first, or do you just outline the roles of the characters, or do you just sit down and write and see what happens?
Well, the sitting down and writing and seeing what happens doesn't work for me.
Okay.
So I usually start with an outline. I mean, well, first of all, just from the very beginning, I just start with kind of an idea of sort of a key problem for the story. And then I start to build scenes around it. And what is the opening going to be? Because you want to hook your reader right away. So what is that opening scene going to be? And then, from there, I just kind of start planning what's going to happen. But the outline can... I'll write an outline and it seems like it's so detailed and I know exactly what's going to happen, and then I get, a little ways into it and things start to change and the story takes a turn and something happens, or as I start to sit down and write something, I realize it doesn't really make sense and so I have to change it. So the outline is kind of a tool, but, I'm not really a slave to it, so it changes as I go.
Well, who reads your novels? I've been asking this question forever. There are so many New York Times bestselling authors, so many authors whose books I read after they come out. Who reads them before they come out? Do you have a beta reader group?
I don't have a beta group. My agent has been amazing over the years, Kevin Lyon, and she's out of California, and she is a great reader, and she loves to read. And so, she's always been gracious enough to read it. I'm always right there, right before the deadline, finishing the story. So I usually don't give her just gobs of time, but, I'll say, can you read this, over the weekend? Because I have to turn it in next week. And she's great about not only reading fast, but also having lots of good feedback. And so she's always my first reader and then my editor. And, but I don't really share it with a bunch of beta readers or friends or family or anything like that. I've occasionally shared a story early. For example, my book that came out last summer is Exposed, and it's about a forensic photographer. And my sister is an amateur photographer, and so I wanted her to read the story just so that she could help me with some of the photography details that I'd researched forensic photography, but I just wanted her eyes on the story to see kind of. And she had some great suggestions in various scenes, I don't think she would really approach that this way because, she'd be trained to think about this. And so, I did some rewriting based on her feedback. But generally speaking, my agent is my first reader and my editor is my second reader.
No, that is good. That's interesting because there are so many authors that have a ton of people. That could be helpful, then it could be detrimental, too, if, you have too many cooks or too many people.
Well, it would probably be helpful if you got your story done on time.
Yeah.
You'd have to get your story finished early and then get it out to people. No, I'm usually right up on that deadline, so I haven't had that possibility of people reading it ahead of time.
Well, you just get suspense in her novels, and you get suspense there. I've been wondering if you ever wrote a book about exactly that, writing a novel and getting it through, you know, suspense, the suspense right to the end until you actually brought it to the editor, and then they kill somebody off in the book before you even get there. How much input does the editor have? In other words, if she says to you that this is really great, or you should change this, or you should change a storyline, do you change it? Or a character, if she said John and Andrea should be doing this and it should be changed to this, would you change it? Mm-hmm. Or would you stick with what
you decide?
You know,
my editor usually doesn't have... Her feedback tends to be a little bit more general. It's not usually like this mm-hmm. one thing you need to change. Mm-hmm. She's not, you know, that specific. It's more like, uh-huh. well, I'm feeling like their relationship isn't developing in the scene or we need more character development here. I'm not really seeing, she says this, but we really haven't seen evidence of that.
Uh-huh.
It, just kind of pointing out, because, you know, a lot of times when you're writing, you have all this in your head, and you think it's there on the page, but it really isn't, because you didn't really put it in the scene. You didn't really put it in the dialogue. You haven't, it's in your head, but you haven't really put it into the book yet. And so she's great at pointing out those things where I think it's there. I assume the reader knows what I'm talking about, but she'll say, you know, this isn't really developed. You know, you kind of allude to this, mm-hmm. but we need more to really understand. And so she's really good at pointing out those areas in the story where I need more development.
Now, if Andrea was standing in front of you to describe John, how would you say she would describe his character, his character traits? And if he was standing in front of her, how would he describe her character traits?
Traits. Well, physically would be one thing. I think that, well, first of all, John is very tall. He's kind of the tall, dark, and handsome. And he's been living out in West Texas working undercover, so he's sunbrown and muscular. He's been doing raids with an ICE team and out in West Texas, and so he's in top physical condition, let's say. But she's immediately defensive about him because he's kind of, at first she kind of sees him as the enemy. He's there investigating her brother. So she's immediately, you know, sees everything as adversarial. So she would probably tell you that he's bossy and arrogant, and that he's kind of trying to be controlling. So she's kind of put off by him mm-hmm. at first. With him, I think when he first meets her, he knows that she's being kind of evasive, and she's a little bit mysterious. She doesn't reveal her name. She doesn't reveal why she's in West Texas. She doesn't really tell him anything about herself, and he has to go, you know, play detective and figure out who the hell is this woman that's here kind of tripping mm-hmm. over my investigation. What is she doing here, and who is she? And so he has to just kind of go on a little mini investigation to even figure out who she is. So he would probably say that she's mysterious and elusive and kind of guarded and defensive. So when they first start in the story, they kind of have these views of each other that as they get to know each other, you know, mm-hmm. the walls kind of break down.
Well, before I forget, because I don't want to forget, next Thursday, I'm going to be interviewing Amy Newmark, Chicken Soup for the Soul, believe it or not, Alzheimer's and Dementia, and Dr. Frank Weinstock, one of the top ophthalmologists in the world. We're going to talk about questions that you need to ask your medical insurance company when you go to a new doctor, the questions that you should ask, the questions that will lead you to maybe choosing someone else, the kind of respect that you're supposed to get, and how to take care of your eyes and your vision. And the week after, one of my favorite hottest detectives, Jonathan Stride, Cold Summer, will be Brian Freeman. It should be really interesting. And May 15th, Larry Thompson, Insanity Plea, if I can remember everything. And May 22nd, John Lesquois, The Keeper. Yeah, it's going to be interesting, the month of May. And next week it should be a lot of fun. And before I forget, there are tons of hosts on The World of Ink. And I don't want to name shows because I don't want to misname them, but I am going to name the hosts that I can remember. Marcia Cook, A Good Story with a Good Story, is usually on Tuesday. You don't want to miss it. The discussion gets great, and she's amazing. Writing Mamas with Virginia Grenier. Willow Cross does a paranormal. Bena Pomerantz does a show on Saturday, and Cassandra Dane does a romance show. And it should be very interesting. And R. Jeffries does a great show on the World of Ink, which is my network. I just didn't want to forget to mention it. My second network is Red River Radio, and there's Delaney Oaks, Karen Vaughn, Barbara Hodgins, Barbara Arantu, and a whole bunch of other great hosts on all of these shows. Then I am really lucky to have met all these people. So my next question is, how long does it take you from start to finish to actually write a whole book?
Oh, gosh, it varies. Let's see. It usually takes me, I can get a draft of the manuscript done in, you know, maybe 8 months. But then the editing process takes months and months after that. You know, my editor will hold on to it for a while, and then she'll send it back for revisions. And all of the revisions are different. Some books, it's quick, and there's not a lot to change. Other books need kind of more of an overhaul. So it just depends on how much is there in revisions. And then it goes through all the process, like the copy edit process and the galleys, which is where the book, it looks like the pages that you actually see in the book once it's printed. And, you know, you're reading that. So all in all, you know, most books from start to finish, it's a year. Well, no. That's inaccurate. It would take me about 8 months to write the manuscript, and then from turning in the manuscript to getting the book out, it can be anywhere from 6 months to a year after that. So
I don't think everybody realizes it's a long process. Yeah, but
well,
just
and
about
that's
every
traditional
book.
Publishing. Digital publishing is much faster. You know, there's it seems like it's all kind of compressed down to a faster time frame. So it just depends.
Well, yeah, e-books do take less time to get on the Internet. But there's also a process for making sure that they come out right, because sometimes they don't always come out right. It depends on who does them. And there are a lot of people that use, you know, Creative Space or Smashwords and stuff that, you know, there are rules in order to how to do that also. That's why I hired somebody to do my magazine. And I wouldn't even attempt to do that by myself.
Yeah.
So when
There's so many people that go into the process of publishing something. It's really kind of mind-boggling when you realize how many people play a role.
It is. It's difficult. If you were to tell a new author something about writing a romance or a mystery novel, what would you suggest? Where do you suggest that they start? Your subject area came from April 19th on that particular day.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you determine what advice would you give them in order to write a good romance novel? Because so many of them are just pure romance, and there's no plot. There's nothing in there that readers want to grab onto or even care. Sometimes you turn the pages and you say, when is this going to be over? I'm going through torture. So how do you keep the suspense and the mystery? Yeah, you know, I've read over 2,500 books that I'm reviewing. And the other book I couldn't remember before is After Party by Daryl Gregory. Boy, it's about a drug called Numinous, and that makes you feel that you see God. It's really scary, the book, and it is good, I have to tell you, those two books. But how do you create the suspense, and how do you keep the reader interested so that they want to, you know, read more?
Well, I don't remember who gave me this advice, but a long time ago, somebody, when I was first starting out as a writer, somebody basically said, you know, you have to write the kind of books that you want to read as a reader, because you can't just walk into a genre that is popular, like, you know, whatever type of fiction, sci-fi. Oh, sci-fi is selling. I think I'll write some sci-fi. I mean, you have to understand what it is you're writing. So write the genre, write the type of book that you like to read. And so for me, I love to read romance novels. I love to read suspense books. I love thrillers. So I'm writing exactly the type of book that I like to read. And so that's where I get all this passion about it, because I like to read that sort of story. So I think that my first advice for aspiring authors would be to write the type of story that you enjoy, because you're going to be passionate about writing. And you're also going to know a lot of the nuances, you know, what's out there already, what's been done, what is kind of overdone. You're going to know ways to be creative with your plot and your characters and to try and do something new. And so, you know, I say write what you love. And then, you know, if you really love what you're writing, if you're really enjoying it, that kind of comes through on the page. So
Actually, I agree with you, because you would have to actually sit down and read the book and say to yourself, I didn't write this. Someone else wrote it, and then read it as if you're reading it through somebody else's eyes, another reader, not yourself, and say, okay, what would I do with this book? Would I put it on my shelf, or would I read it again, or would I tell people this is the most amazing book? Or if I could rate the book myself, would I give myself 5 stars?
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, one other thing that I will say is that I also don't want people to feel like they need to be kind of slaves to what conventions are already out there. I mean, maybe if you write the type of book that you love, it may not exist yet. I mean, you may be making a new type of book. You may be writing something that isn't out there already, and that's okay. I mean, if you really are passionate about your idea and you really just have this thing in mind, whether it's the story or the characters or whatever it is, you know, as long as you're passionate about it, I think that's what's going to come through in your writing. But it may not be something that is already out there. I mean, the first people to write, stories that kind of broke the molds, they're sometimes hard to market those things at first because you don't know where they fit in, but it could be a wonderful story.
Yeah, the hard part is, I agree with you, that, you know, you want to do something unique and different, but how do you get a publishing company to recognize that your book is unique and different? So most of these people wind up self-publishing the book themselves or putting it on Creative Space, which is fine, or any one of the online areas where you can publish it yourself, you know, and do it yourself. Mm-hmm. That's the hard part. And then marketing the book, I mean, your publishing company, your book came out April 15th, right?
April the 15th, that's right.
See how good? That's pretty good. And I'm going to post the review after the show. I was going to post a review first, but I didn't want to give anything away. But anybody out there that didn't read it, I don't know what's wrong with them. But I have one last question. This is a strange one.
Okay.
Did you ever kill off a main character? And if you could change anything about Fargon, the novel itself, would you change anything?
Oh, gosh. I can't remember. Fargon is my 12th book, and I can't remember whether I've ever killed off a main character. I've never killed off the heroine, I can tell you that. But, you know, I won't ever say never because you never know what's going to happen. I mean, you never know where your story is going to go, so I won't say what I'll never do, but to this point, I've never killed off my heroine.
No, I read John Lesquart's book, and I never know who's going to get killed off.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it's more exciting. Sometimes I like reading the authors where I just don't know what's going to happen. And somebody you think is a good guy could turn out to be a bad guy. You know, I like that suspense. I don't like being able to predict everything in advance. So preserve some of the suspense. Never say never.
Well, the ending of this book surprised me, and I won't tell you why. And
you won't tell me why, or you will?
I'm not going to say.
Please don't tell me why, but it includes spoilers.
That's why I wouldn't say it. The ending was good. It was good because people won't expect it. You would figure that after all the things that happened throughout the whole novel, that there would have been a different ending with certain characters, and it made sense.
Mm-hmm.
It made sense, but I was, and I said, but then it didn't make sense, and I said, yeah, you left room for more than just John and Andrea to come back too, which was great because she left the story wide open, which makes me really happy, hoping that you'll write another one and bring a whole bunch of people back.
Good.
So before we go, can you tell everyone, we know what is next, the Tracer's novel is coming, and of course she's going to bring John and Andrea back to make Fran happy, we hope.
Yes.
And if you ever do anything with education or reading or stuff like that, I'm an expert. That's what I learned. And my field is as a reading and writing staff developer. But where can people get to know more about you and your books?
Yeah, you can visit my website, and the website is www.lauragriffin.com. And I talk all about my books. I talk about the Tracer series, what inspired the Tracer series. I update the news page there, so for events coming up. And then I'm also on Facebook at Facebook Laura Griffin Author. And then I'm also on Twitter, and I use Twitter just to kind of communicate, just conversation back and forth with people. So those are the three places where you can get more information. Oh, and I also love to hear from readers. So if you want to drop me an email, my email address is laura@lauragriffin.com.
That's how I found you. I was so lucky.
Okay.
I found you on Writer Space, but I'm going to send you, after the show, a copy of MJ Magazine.
Please do. Thank you.
I would be totally honored if you wrote an article on exactly what we were talking about, how you create your novel or what people should write about or anything that you want to write about.
Mm-hmm.
You can look through the table of contents, but before I forget, Laura's books in the Traces series are, I have the bookmark in front of me, I don't lose anything, Exposed, Scorched, Twisted, Snap, Unforgivable, Unspeakable, Untraceable, and yeah, I read them all, every
Yay.
One of them. Yep, I did, so haha. And the bookmark is signed, so nobody's getting it. No one's getting the book because it's been signed, and my brother-in-law asked to read it, and I said, no, buy it yourself, because he never gives anything back. I mean, he doesn't ever give anything. Nobody gives anything back, and it's really bad. But my picks for the month are really good, and I want to thank you so much. And please let me know when the next one comes out, because
I will.
Next spring, you never know where I'll be, what I'm going to be doing.
Fran, thanks for having me.
You're welcome, and thank you for coming on the show. And everybody, have a great evening, and good night.
Good night.